And if you want to be a part of the conversation too, then subscribe to my Patreon, www.patreon.com/Mr. Chaz, and join the conversation. Ask your own questions.
Sometimes those things that look so good, you know, like, oh, I want my kid to follow rules and I want my kid to do things safely and get good grades and take school seriously and take things seriously and be kind and all those things, aren't really the child's genuine, the child being connected to how they really feel in the moment, what they really want to do in the moment, and what really adds value to their moment. It's really an anxiety response. Really commonly, families that have a lot of distress, especially if the parents, if it's either like only one parent or the parents don't sufficiently attune to each other and assuage each other's negative emotion and connect with one another, that child who's born into the system that naturally has low neuroticism, like no low negative emotion, and is naturally pretty responsible, that the parents who are feeling really disconnected and kind of insecure themselves are going to zero in on that kid and make that kid like reassure them for their inadequacies and insecurities and for the negative feelings that they feel. And that kid is going to be conditioned to do that all the time first, to please and to achieve and all that stuff first before they even check in to how they're feeling. And then, like I say a lot, Mr. Chaz, it's actually really sad. Instead of forming an identity, these kids form an anxiety response. And that is not, I think, like if parents know about this stuff, they don't want their kid to experience this. So I just think we don't talk about it. And I don't think parents know what's going on. They have a soldier on their hands. They have somebody that's not acting like they're stressed out. And the golden child is hiding it under the surface, so the parents think everything is fine.
What's my name? What's my name? What's my name?
Welcome to Mr. Chaz's Leadership, Parenting, and Teaching Podcast, where I introduce you to the people that can help you on your leadership, parenting, or teaching journey. And today, I have a guest that you may or may not have heard of before, but I'm going to let her introduce herself, and then we're going to dive into a great conversation about regulation and relationships and so many other things that I know the audience will be excited to hear about. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chaz. So my name is Angelica Shields, and I'm actually a clinical psychologist in Maryland, and I had my first foray into social media in September, a couple months ago, so I'm kind of new to this, but I just started talking to folks about relationship topics, about everything from family of origin to parenting to partner issues, and it seems to be something that a lot of people want to hear about, so I kind of consider myself a psychologist who specializes in relationships. Thank you for having me.
A psychologist who specializes in relationships. So let me ask you this, and I know I might be throwing you for a loop already in the beginning, but why did you decide to specialize in relationships?
I actually received my training in children and families. So I just started working and I found certain topics kept coming up over and over and over that were more related to anxieties and attachment anxieties rather than what we were talking about on the surface. And so it just kind of very organically became necessary to educate myself about and intervene more with those topics.
Okay. You said attachment anxiety. We've talked about attachment a little bit on this podcast, but can you tell us more about what you mean when you say attachment anxiety?
Okay. So attachment just means how you relate to another person. So sometimes I'll say your comfort level with connection and conflict. Sometimes people will say like vulnerability or emotions, intimacy, things like that. And attachment can apply to how you are with friends, but usually I apply, or coworkers or things like that. But usually we talk about it in terms of your attachment to a caregiver if you're a child, and your attachment to your partner if you're an adult, like a romantic relationship. And anxieties are when that stuff that I just talked about doesn't feel comfortable. What's your reaction? And some people have what's called avoidant attachment. And that's when during connection, during intimacy, during conflict, they avoid the whole thing. Like they don't want to talk about it. They might become defensive. They might change the subject. They might people please. They do something to just shut it down. They might withdraw or do something called stonewalling, where you just walk away or you leave the house during that conversation. And then there's another broad type of attachment, which in the research is called dismissive attachment. And that's when somebody, it's called dismissive because the research that was done on the infants observed that the infants were like pushing. Comfort. But as adults, I call it reactive, because these adults who are dismissive become very reactive. They'll start fights. They'll be very demanding. They'll try to control the environment around them. They'll say like, why didn't you do the dishes? What's wrong with you? That kind of thing. And then the third category is a mix of the first two types of attachment. It's called disorganized, and they do a combination of avoiding and reacting.
So I'm sorry, and it might've cut out a little bit too. I just want to make sure that we got this and everyone heard this. The dismissive attachment you mentioned, that is when they kind of push away. And you were saying they noticed the baby would do what? They would push away instead of, say that part again?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the original research on this, Mr. Chaz, was in the 1960s. And a researcher named Mary Ainsworth actually set up a situation where she had little one-year-olds interact with their caregiver. It was all mothers. And then the mother would leave the room and a stranger would come in the room. So, of course, every single child was really distressed by that. And then the stranger would leave and the child is still distressed. And the mother would come back. And then Mary Ainsworth would just document, how did these one-year-olds respond to this situation? Did they go toward the mother? And actually, I didn't explain this. It's called secure attachment. The three that I was just describing are the anxious attachments, but these infants that went toward the mother and received their comfort have secure attachment. So during intimate moments or vulnerable moments where they needed something from another person, they were comfortable with it. And then the dismissives, like you were saying, they had the mother try to give them comfort, but they were not having it. They would like try to push them away and turn away. And they showed that they weren't comfortable with that intimate moment and getting comfort from their mother by resisting it.
Mm. And, you know, I also, when I was watching your content, I also noticed that you, and right now we're talking about, you know, attachment styles for, you know, you're describing like infants and the research that was done with infants, but you also talk about adults and kind of what all this stuff kind of looks like in adults. And you kind of, what really intrigued me is kind of like the different personalities that you were talking about and how the different personalities kind of interacted with each other in these different relationships, almost these different attachment styles would interact in relationships. And that was really interesting. And to see how you were also talking about how kind of those personality types were created. Could you tell us a little bit more about that? The one that comes to my mind is like, I remember there was one you said, like you were talking about the golden boy, and then the hippy dippy. So could you talk a little bit about that? Teach us a little bit about like, what does it look like with these different kind of attachment styles, personality types for adults?
Okay, Mr. Chaz, this is quite the question. Okay, let me clarify. With the personality types, there are well-known features in psychology that are all included in this personality measurement called the Big Five personality test. It's used in a lot of psychological research. And those five different aspects of the Big Five are neuroticism, extroversion, conscientiousness, agreeableness, and openness. And then there was research done to figure out which of those Big Five personality features weighed the most heavily on relationship outcomes in adulthood. And theoretically, these inborn characteristics, or I'm sorry, theoretically, these features that I just listed off are inborn, like they're temperaments. They're not, they don't come about by like stressors or life experiences. Now, how these Big Five features show up in relationships are wildly fluctuating depending on stressors. But when you look up the Big Five and you look up personality research, when they're describing like neuroticism, extroversion, openness, whatever, they're talking about something that's stable throughout life. It's just that when we're stressed out, they temporarily fluctuate and relationships stress us out. So yeah. I give full disclosure, Mr. Chaz, I took the two top features, characteristics that affect relationships the most, neuroticism, which just means negative emotion, like anger, jealousy, anxiety, fear, things like that, and conscientiousness, which means how responsible you are, how much of a follow-through person you are, how reliable you are, how much attention to detail. So I just took those two features and I put them in different, I matched them up, like high neuroticism, high conscientiousness, low neuroticism. And I did the four different combinations of that. And then I made up names for them. So you won't, I call the big boss the one that has high conscientiousness and high neuroticism, but I'll call somebody who has low conscientiousness and high neuroticism hopeless, or I'll call like the person that has high conscientiousness and low neuroticism a hero. I think I got that right. I don't know. Yeah. Okay. I made up the hero, the hippie, the hopeless. I made that up based on actual known well-researched temperamental features that we know in psychology that affect relationships. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, finish. Keep going.
So as far as the golden child or the parentified child or the scapegoated child, those are different labels. And a golden child usually shows up with high conscientiousness, low neuroticism. They have low negative emotion, but responsible. And so they end up being a golden child. Now, a scapegoated child might have been born temperamentally with high neuroticism and maybe low conscientiousness. You know, they might have had like more of the hopeless presentation. And so they become scapegoated. And that means like the family system, when they're trying to get rid of their negative energy and mom and dad are frustrated and they can't go toward each other and regulate each other and they want to take it out on the kid, they might take it, that kid who has high neuroticism might show a little bit of normal human emotion like anger or fear. And then boom, they become a receptacle. They become scapegoated for that, the parent's negative energy. So commonly certain personality types take on certain roles in the family. They're two separate things though. The roles in the family are the golden child, the parentified child, the scapegoated child, the lost child. And those roles in the family are not what you're born with. Those are because you're born with these certain temperaments and the family treats you a certain way, you develop these, I don't know, caricatures, I guess. And I did not make up those terms. Those terms are well known in family systems therapy. So they've been around since the 1960s.
Yeah. So the parentified child, the golden boy, the scapegoat child, and I think there's one other one that you said
the lost child.
The lost child. Can you describe the lost child
for me? Yeah. Oftentimes so the lost child, sometimes people will think about it as the child, like the last child in a long line of siblings, and nobody ever thinks about them. They're kind of neglected. But the lost child just means that they're emotionally neglected. So it's possible that the lost child got a lot of attention Had food on the table for them, got new sneakers every season, had Christmas presents under the Christmas tree, you know, all of that stuff, but could still be lost, still have some of the qualities of the lost child if they weren't attuned to emotionally at all, if they were neglected emotionally.
Okay, so let's say that you are you're a parent and you have a child who has a tendency, I think you said the low neuroticism and high, what was the other one?
Yes,
And
I know.
high conscientiousness. And you have a child who's, likely to be the, golden boy. And you kind of see that. And now you're listening to this podcast and you're like, okay, is this a good thing? Is this something that I want to reinforce? Do I want to continue treating him or her? Because I imagine you could be a golden girl too, potentially. Is this something that is a good thing that I want to keep continue reinforcing? Or is this something that I need to maybe pay a little bit more attention to and potentially adjust my parenting or my communication or my actions or adjust something to make sure that my child who is has low neuroticism and high conscientiousness turns out okay. And doesn't have these mental health issues of just, of that a lot of us do have.
You are hitting the nail on the head, Mr. Chaz. You ask really good questions. So let me just explain a little bit really quickly what the golden child is. You're right. It usually comes out of the hero temperament. So you're born with low neuroticism and high conscientiousness. You're able to be the golden child. The golden child is high achieving, follows the rules, doesn't ruffle feathers, is pretty passive. Does whatever is needed in the family to keep stability and keep peace, and is going to want, like I said, to be high achieving. Is going to do whatever the culture phrases as good. So pretty good in school, good in sports, things like that. And I'm so glad you're an asking this question because so many parents are like, "Isn't that a good thing?" And it is a good thing if it's not out of anxiety, if it's not a role the kid has to play to keep peace in the system, if it's not conditioned in that child that if there's a problem or if there's tension, they better be perfect. Otherwise, it's going to be there's going to be a bigger problem, you know? Sometimes those things that look so good, you know, like, oh, I want my kid to follow rules and I want my kid to do things safely and get good grades and take school seriously and take things seriously and be kind and all those things aren't really the child's genuine the child being connected to how they really feel in the moment and what they really want to do in the moment and what really adds value to their moment. It's really an anxiety response. Really commonly, families that have a lot of distress, especially if the parents, if it's either like only one parent or the parents don't sufficiently attune to each other and assuage each other's negative emotion and connect with one another, that child who's born into the system that ha naturally has low neuroticism, like no low negative emotion, and is naturally pretty responsible. That the parents who are feeling really disconnected and kind of insecure themselves are going to zero in on that kid and make that kid like reassure them for their inadequacies and insecurities and for the negative feelings that they feel. And that kid is going to be conditioned to do that all the time first, to please and to achieve and all that stuff first before they even check in to how they're feeling. And then, like I say a lot, Mr. Chaz, it's actually really sad. Instead of forming an identity, these kids form an anxiety response. And that is not, I think, like if parents know about this stuff, they don't want their kid to experience this. So I just think we don't talk about it. And I don't think parents know what's going on. They have a soldier on their hands. They have somebody that's not acting like they're stressed out. And the golden child is hiding it under the surface, so the parents think everything is fine.
Well, how do you tell the difference? You know, it's my next question. How do you know if you have a child who is high achieving? Okay, some of these features are they seem familiar to me. I see this in my child. But I don't know if it's coming from an anxiety response or if it's coming from them being intrinsically motivated to achieve these things. How do I, as a parent, know the difference?
You ask the best questions. And no human is intrinsically motivated to always be perfect. We are intrinsically motivated to be accepted and not be cast out from the group and be accepted for who we are and have a sense of belonging. And that actually motivates a lot. That motivates a lot of achievement sometimes. But we're not motivated to be perfect naturally. So I would say the answer to that question is your child comfortable and feel comfortable with you in particular, first with themselves, and then you'll notice if they don't feel comfortable with you in moments where they're not perfect. And if they can tolerate that, and some of the disappointments of life or the mistakes of life, are kind of more casual or something that they are comfortable experiencing with themselves and experiencing in the context of another person, and they don't feel like that's going to compromise the other person's loving of them, accepting of them. There's where you see the difference. That's where that's not a golden child. That's somebody that just really likes baseball, you know?
So if a child, if you notice that a child is, you have a golden child and you notice that they when they make mistakes, they tend to be hard on themselves, or they tend to really fear making mistakes, or really uncomfortable, or feel like, maybe turn their head away or feel shameful when they do make mistakes, that's a sign that they're high achieving features are coming from anxiety and anxiety response as opposed to intrinsic motivation and wanting to be connected and belonging to the community and group is.
100%. I think you are again, you're hitting on something really, really important, Mr. Chaz, which is body language. So I talk a lot about attunement. How do we know what's ever really going on with someone? We don't really know. We're not living in their bodies, but we pay attention. We're attuned to what's going on with them. And we notice little things. And when you just said, like, oh, the child is turning away. That makes me think like you have a lot of experience tuning in with children because that's what they do. Well, that's what humans do, but like more hard on their sleeve, obvious when they're young, you know, they're not going to try it. They're just going to turn away. So I think I'm really glad that you brought that up. I think I'm just like mirroring back what you just said. Yes, repeat it for the people in the back. Pay attention to your kids' nonverbals.
And so, okay, you recognize, and honestly, here we talk all the time. I'm glad we started off with a golden child because I mean, we talk all the time. My like tagline is avoid being a perfectionist, be an improvist. The goal isn't to be perfect every day. The goal is to improve a little
Yes.
every day.
Yes.
And so, yeah, this is something that we talk about a lot. And I'm glad that I have yet another person come on here and without completely planning it, reinforce the importance of just, creating that culture of allowing kind of mistakes. Do you have any kind of recommendations of how a parent, maybe you notice that it is coming from high anxiety, an anxiety response, of something you can do to kind of start to make that shift to where we can lower the anxiety, we can increase the feelings of you're accepted, you belong. Like, what are some, you have any ideas of how we can maybe start to do this?
Yep, you came to the right place. I got lots of ideas on this. I think this is the most important thing that we can do for our kids. And I always say there's an a mindset behind attunement, and the attunement mindset is going through life in your everyday life around other people, especially your children, your partner, and yourself, observing and accepting, not judging and controlling. So that's what I call the attunement mindset. You're like, yes,
Yeah.
you're. So what kinds of statements, what kinds of body language, what kinds of tone would you have that kind of extends naturally from the attunement mindset? You would say things like, you would make observational statements like, I noticed this. You wouldn't say, why are you always doing this? Your tone of voice would be more calm, instead of like sharp and aggressive and like having that judgment tone to it. And then the acceptance would be in your behavior. So sitting right down next to the kid, asking if the kid needs some help, just not being tight and frantic yourself when the kid makes a mistake. That signals to the kid's nervous system, like all these like unconscious processes that are detecting every single thing that happens between you, that that the kid's being accepted. So I really think it starts with a mindset, and then the behaviors and what you say kind of extend from that.
Yeah, and just to add on to that, I think one of the most powerful things that we can do in teaching children that mistakes are opportunities for learning, they're not like they're essential, and they're important and they're valuable, and there's no shame that needs to be around it, is by talking about our own mistakes. And when we make mistakes, pointing them out and talking about them and talking about how you're going to kind of like repair from the mistake that you made, and is making it a normal thing, because children see us, children see adults make mistakes not as often as they see themselves make mistakes, because they're so young that they're learning about everything. Right. And I said mistakes are an essential part of the learning process. And they're learning so much. So of course they're going to be making more mistakes than us. But us as adults, even with our decades of experience, are still making mistakes all over the place, whether or not we learn to admit it or acknowledge it or not. We're still making mistakes all over the place. So I know it's really powerful. And I've seen it be really powerful that when mistakes happen, and I think a lot of times we have to kind of regulate ourselves, because we have kind of been conditioned to react in a certain way to mistakes, to really learn to accept it, to talk about it, and in a way that there's no shame in what to do to repair afterwards. And so that's kind of my two cents of one of the many things that we can do to, increase that belongingness and decrease the shame around making mistakes and messing up.
I'm writing this down, Mr. Chaz. You hit on three really, really important things. I might want to talk about this on one of my TikToks. Okay. So seriously, the modeling, huge. And modeling, normalizing, making mistakes. And then you also said regulating yourself, which I'm just talking about the attunement mindset. I'm not talking about how the heck do you get the attunement mindset. Well, regulating yourself, you're hitting the nail on the head. I think a lot of us adults are so tied to our own childhood shame, perfection, anxiety responses, trying to prove something about our own identity that we're not bad, that we have a really hard time accepting and or observing and accepting, I'll say imperfection in another person. And sometimes people catastrophize these minor things. Did you want to say something?
No, I'm disagreeing with you visually.
You know what? I just talked about this, and my son said that I could talk about it openly. So I'm going to use it as an example. Yesterday morning, my son, who's very like one of those high, he's one of those heroes, like high, low neuroticism, high conscientiousness. He opens up his binder and he's like, oh my gosh, you could see the franticness on his face. I was supposed to hand this assignment in 3 weeks ago. It's overdue. And if I could say all day long, oh, I'm supposed to have the attunement mindset, observe and accept. But if I'm not regulated to not be afraid of him failing out of science class, or did I do a bad job as a parent and not teach him to be responsible enough? Like, what did I do wrong? Am I bad? Is he going to be bad? Is this like a catastrophic thing? If I'm not regulated enough to be able to be calm through whatever comes up in me, I'm going to lose the attunement mindset. I'm not going to be observing and accepting. I'm going to be judging. What's the opposite of that? Like judging and controlling and managing the situation. I'm probably going to get frantic to him. So I'm really glad that you brought that up. I'm actually, because I think that regulating yourself in order to be able to be attuned is so overlooked in these conversations and so important. I'm actually releasing a series on TikTok about exactly that, because I was thinking, hey, it's the holiday season. People are celebrating these holidays where the kids are asking for certain gifts. And I was thinking, what does every child really want? What is every child doesn't know to ask for this from their parents, but what do they really want? They want the attunement mindset with their parents. That's what they want more than a set of rollerblades or a set of Legos or whatever. And so I'm releasing on TikTok a kind of step-by-step way to for parents and partners to regulate themselves so that they can achieve the attunement mindset.
So how did you respond to your son who was really upset? He was really concerned about, you know, not turning in the work.
Yeah, it's weird. I just skipped right over that part. I'm with my kids. I have three boys. And what I've noticed about them is they really respond well to nonverbals more than verbals. So less talk, more action. I hand on the shoulder usually works. Oh, babe, I know you know what to do. Like something like that. Tone of voice really matters. I think I said something like that. Like, you got this, babe. Something like that. Like the honeys or whatever, just kind of give their nervous system the impression like it's safe. You can't be mad at people and calling them honey. So it's like incompatible. And then we have been through this enough that he didn't need the guidance. But I would have given, if he was at a loss and didn't know what to do in this situation, I would have waited until he was calm. And then I would have said, probably what you were talking about, the modeling. I would have said, when I was in middle school and I would forget to do something, this is what I would do. Or if I would forget to hand something in, this is what I would do. When I was in middle school, I didn't have email. So I did things a little bit different. But what I've guided him to do, and he's taken my suggestion, because I give it as a suggestion instead of as a control thing. And then they feel safe to try it and fail if it doesn't work. Is he took a picture of the assignment and emailed it to the teacher, and with like a humble acknowledgement, like, I forgot, it's okay if I don't get credit for it, but I just wanted to let you know I did it. So that's what I'm thinking. It didn't take much fancy footwork on my part. It just took like a nonverbal, like, I'm here with you and I'm not attacking or judging you.
Yeah. So you just, how old is he?
He's 13.
Okay. And so he just really in that time just needed to be heard, right? It sounds like you were just there to kind of just hear him, kind of help him kind of do a little bit of that co-regulation kind of in the beginning so that he could access. And I practice consciousness, a program called Conscious Discipline. And I'm, for those in the podcast world, I'm pointing to the green part of the brain, so that he could kind of access his higher parts of his brain, so to speak. And then problem solve himself, right? Is that kind of what?
Yes. Yes. I think you said he needed to be heard, and some kids do need to be heard. And whenever I do couples therapy, we always start with that. Like, make sure you validate the other person. Make sure you reflect what you heard them say. With him, I have one kid who's a little bit more verbal and I need to reflect that he is stressed out and give words to it. With him, it's more physical. And then he gets the green part of the brain. Mm-hmm. Like if I'm touching his shoulder and I'm like, just with him with kind of a chill tone, then he's in the green part of the brain. So I feel like you just got to be attuned to your people and know what they need to be regulated.
You know, and I kind of, I think even just like the, a little, you know, when I'm saying like, you know, to be heard, I think, yes, like you're saying, kind of mirroring back what they're saying and validating emotions is kind of one way you can do it. But I think you can hear someone, and someone can feel heard and understood with the look, right? Yeah. With the look, with the, right? With the, there's so many I think a lot of times we do, to your point, like we do sometimes use more words than what is needed in the moment. And really what they need is our energy and our understanding and our presence and our connection. And that doesn't always require words. And sometimes if it does require words, it doesn't really require many words. And I think too, and I asked about the age too, because, you know, I think the way that I kind of look at when they're younger, you're doing a lot of regulating, and then because they don't know, you know, they're still figuring out problem solving and kind of like, okay, well, what can I do in this situation? You know, you're doing a lot of regulating, and then you're, you know, providing some guidance. And this is something from me, I always say, see, guide, trust. And the idea is that we have to be able to see a person before we're able to effectively guide them. What most adults try to do is, you know, we think we have, you know, this infinite wisdom, and that if children could just listen to us and everything would be rainbows and butterflies and sunshine. But the problem is a lot of times, you know, we try to guide them before we actually can even see them. So it's like we're trying to almost guide them in the dark, and we're like reaching out to them, and we're like, we don't connect with them. It's like, okay, like, why aren't you coming with us? And then and seeing a person does two big things. One, when a person feels seen and understood, you actually have your guidance is actually can actually connect with them. You can actually target your guidance to what their problem is as they see it. Because a lot of times you try to guide children, and the problem we think that they're having and the problem that they think they're having are two different problems. And so it doesn't connect, right? And they're like, why didn't you take my advice? It's like, because you didn't really give them advice for what they wanted advice for. And the other big thing is that when a person feels seen, they're more willing to go on the journey with you rather than what a lot of adults try to do with children and drag them along with the journey, with, you know, through fear and control, kind of like what you were saying. And, you know, and, you know, I love kind of how you talked about what you did with your son, because there wasn't really any control in it. Parents can, you know, I love that you talked about that fear of him flunking out of science, because we create these stories of kind of worst case scenario, and we get dysregulated, and then we're in this judgment and like control, mm-hmm. like we get into that mode, and it shuts down their communication, and then we're not able to guide them. But I love how you really just were just there for him. And my guess is that he probably knew to do that. He probably was able to figure that out and problem solve, because there are probably many times in his younger years where you were, you know, you were able to help him learn how to problem solve different situations. Oh, okay. I froze, but I'm back. Hopefully the recording got me. I guess I'll check that later. But, you know, what I was saying is that I really appreciate how you were just there for him. And I suspect that you have, in his younger years, you're probably offering a lot more guidance. And now he's in his teen years, and it's like, one, they probably want a lot less guidance than they did when they were younger. And two, because guess, and you tell me if I'm wrong, that because you've given him, you were able to see him and therefore guide him and regulate, and therefore also kind of access those higher parts of the brain, so you could work on that problem solving part of the brain. Then now as a teen, he's better. I'm not going to say perfect, because we're still teen. A part of the brain's not fully developed at 25, 26. So let's not get ahead of ourselves, but still much more capable and much better at problem solving because of all the work that you did when you were younger. Now, tell me if I was wrong. Like, okay, Mr. Chaz, you missed the boat on this one. Mistakes are an opportunity for learning. So if I made a mistake, please tell me. But if not, also tell me.
Mr. Chaz, you know you're right. You know, you're 100% right. The only thing that you got wrong is that when that particular son, he's the most high in neuroticism of all of my kids, and they're all low in neuroticism, but he would be like more vocal. And when that particular son was very, very young, I made so many mistakes. So I want to get this across.
Oh, I love this part. Yes.
Across that, who coined this? I want to say it was Margaret Mahler. There was some 1960s psychologist that coined the phrase good enough parenting. Well, the mothers, so it was good enough mothering, probably, but good enough parenting. I was attuned enough. I made a lot of mistakes. I can remember a lot of situations, especially with him. And I think I want to stop making it so personal out of respect to him, but I'm gonna say this, like more generally. If a child has a different personality, temperament than the parents or than the rest of the family, it can be very hard to attune with naturally. And it might look a little bumpy at first, and it needs to be a little bit intentional. And I think if you get it, if you're a parent who ends up getting it, but there's some bumps along the way, that's good enough. So what my journey was with him. So
And we never got the age of your other children. Could you, or do you mind sharing?
they're almost 16 and almost 12.
Almost 16, almost 12, and 13.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're in the teen years. And so I would actually like to ask a little bit more about that of how was that journey for you, and how did it's like you mentioned good enough parenting, but what was your journey into improving kind of your parent? Because you strike me as someone who has worked to improve and has been thoughtful about trying to get better at how you're guiding or regulating or relating to your children.
Thank you. Okay, so the question you're asking me is
How did you improve?
how did I go from like
What
low?
was the improvement process like?
Oh, Mr. Chaz, this is a hard question. My instinct of how to answer this is more gut, is more emotional rather than analytical. Of course, I'm a psychologist and I'm always learning new things and reading whatever. But with my kids, it wasn't because I had read something in a book or listened to an awesome podcast. It was because I saw something in them that I just like, just I don't know. This is hopefully relatable and natural to a lot of people, but for me, it was so overwhelming. Like you just want to get it right because you just don't want them to be frantic. You just don't want them to be distressed, and you want to give them the right. Oh, this is something that maybe my schooling did help with. I did know through training on anxiety and through classes on anxiety that if you reassure distress in a person, it temporarily makes them feel better, but it long term gives them problems down the road. So I did know that, but mostly it was not analytical, it was just heartfelt. If there's something going on with them, I want to heal it. If there's something going on with them, I want them to feel good, but feel good in a way that's like, I don't want them to walk around feeling like there's something wrong with them. I want them to feel confident and, but it wasn't like I want them to feel reassured that they're good all the time. Because like I said, I had the anxiety training to know that reassurance brings out problems down the road. Like if I said, oh, you did such a good job, you got all A's on your report card, that just felt off to me, probably because of my training, attuning because of my like how I was as a mother, just kind of naturally was like, how do I really want them to feel? Oh, they want to feel understood. Oh, they want me to be with them and make it about them instead of making it about frantically assuaging my distress. It was just more natural. So I know that's not that's not like a really like usable answer, but that was my journey.
It's usable. I think it's a couple of things that I heard. I think one thing you heard is that you're just, and I think that's very relatable that you had this strong desire to not mess it up, right? And to do the best that you could for your children. And I imagine that kind of emotion stirred up in you. I know that emotion stirred up in you inspires you and drives you to, you know, try the thing that is maybe a little uncomfortable, where, you know, maybe you, your reaction and your instinct is to be like, no, you're not, like, to kind of like, if they say like, oh, I'm so stupid, and you're another reaction to be like, no, you're not stupid. You're the smartest boy in the world. You're, you know, you're brilliant. You know, like, that is your, you know, the instinct reaction. You want to do it. And I, and to even like do approach it differently, and to be able to kind of like pause on that, like that reaction, it takes a lot of gumption. Is the word that comes to mind. And I think it also just speaks to just, you know, we are going to, all along the way, all along our journey, we're going to make mistakes. It is a essential part of the journey. I don't even say that it's a part of the journey. Like, it is an important, essential part of the journey of learning and growing, and especially of the of the parenting journey, especially of the childing journey, right? Of just the human journey. And I want to thank you very much to speaking to that, because many of us have, and, you know, we might have different combinations of, you know, features, but many of us really do struggle with beating ourselves up when we don't, things don't go the way that we hope they would go, or we expected it would go. And that really stops us from the, from actually learning and actually improving and actually, you know, repairing. So I think that's just really important. And I actually wanted to ask about, are there, it sounds like the golden boy is very close to you, like that one is very close to you. Can you, is there another one that is, and you don't have to name which child it is, but is there another one that is like very close to you that you care a lot about?
In my little group of loved ones, whether it's my family of origin, or whether, like, you know, I have sister and brothers, or whether it's my family now, I have all of the types that are near and dear. You're asking about my family right now, like with my kids. I think one of my kids could have very easily been a lost boy, low needs, easygoing, very independent, you know, temperamentally. Not a squeaky wheel at all. Could have very easily been lost. I could have, that kid that I was just talking about could have been a scapegoat, because a little, even though not high neuroticism, a little bit more negative emotion than everybody else. Well, that's who has the target on their back, you know?
Yeah.
What's wrong with you? Why are you sensitive? Is that the question you were asking?
Yeah. And I guess, because we're kind of coming close to our time here. And I would just say, for people who want to learn more, please follow her on Instagram and TikTok, Dr. Angelica. You should be able to find her. When I typed her in social media, she pops up. She talks about this. And like she mentioned before, she has a series coming out on TikTok that you can get access to. But you kind of have all, you just mentioned that, like, okay, one child could have been a lost boy. It could have been this, could have been that, could have been a scapegoat. Is there any label that, like, is more on like the positive side? Like, is there a way that we can, like, is there any label that, like, maybe they could have been a scapegoat, but then I adjusted the way I responded this way, and now they just whoever they are, like, I
like a reformed scapegoat, a narrow miss scapegoat. No, well, with these terms, they were all made up long decades ago, and they refer to roles that are given to the child because something needs to manage the distress in the family system. So the child that ends up secure and not used as a role doesn't have a name. It's just a child that gets to be a kid that gets to be.
Maybe there's no, they're just their name. They're just Johnny. Yes. They're just Jaden. They're just Angelica, right?
True.
It's
Yes.
just Chaz.
I actually love that. And you, every parent wants to make their kid be able to be just Chaz, you know? Oh.
I think that's a beautiful way to end it.
Okay. Thank you so much for having me, Mr. Chaz.
Yeah, thank you for coming on. Is there any last things that you do want to say to the world, to the audience?
I talk a lot about attunement. Attunement is notice what's going on with your kid. Notice what's going on with your partner. And try to take just, I know this is really, really hard for people. If you notice it, try to take one breath while you accept what's in front of you, while you accept the person's emotion, while you accept the fact that you didn't turn in the assignment, while you accept the fact that, I don't know, your spouse is annoyed with you without doing anything about it. And I think the attunement mindset is really, really hard. But if you train yourself with one breath at a time, each of those breaths is a victory. Even if then you manage and judge right after, whatever. It's a victory. It's training your brain to do something different.
What's my name? What's my name? What's